Welcome, everybody. This is the second lecture of the online Mises Academy class, The Economics of Obamacare. As you can tell from the backdrop here, I've switched venues. I'm hoping the internet connection here at my house is more reliable than the one that I was using in my office, which the one in my office, when it works, it's wonderful, but for whatever reason, it occasionally was on the fritz, and so let's see if this one works. So by all means, you know, send me emails or whatever, put something in the Q&A to let me know if you notice a difference between the connectivity here versus what I was doing from my office. Okay, so tonight, tonight's lecture is Promises versus Reality. And here I'm going to, let me just explain this so you guys understand. It's a bit difficult for me to teach a course like this because there's a lot of you signed up. Okay, there's well over 100 people who signed up for this course. And so the difficulty is some of you have very little background knowledge. Like, you know, you knew that, oh yeah, the government's doing something with those things called Obamacare. I don't really know what it is, but I bet it's going to be terrible. And so you signed up for this course just to get a, you know, a crash course, the basics, what the heck is even going on? What does this mean? Am I going to have to start paying something or what's going on? And so for people like that, especially younger people who, you know, might not be aware of what Medicare is and all that, I don't want to leave them behind. And so I'm trying to cover the basics. But then there's other people who are really serious policy wonks and get into the debate and were wanting me to give real fine-tuned, subtle details. Okay, so the compromise I'm going to do to try to cater to both groups is in these main lectures, it's going to be more big picture. And then if you have really specific questions, I'm going to try to hit them. You know, so if you write them in the Q&A, I can answer them then if I know the exact answer or, you know, come back to you. Having said that, let me say there's still a bunch of great questions you guys submitted at the end of last class. Some of them I think I'm going to answer either directly or indirectly in tonight's main lecture and then possibly next week's. But for sure, I'm saving the files of all those Q&As and I'm going to make sure before the, you know, the last class ends that I haven't ignored anybody's question, but I'm just letting you know in case you think I'm ignoring it. Part of the answer could be that I know I'm going to cover that like next week in the main lecture, so that's why I'm not answering it separately. Okay, so again, for those of you who are logged in here live, if you have a question for me at the end of tonight's lectures, put it in the Q&A box, whereas the chat box is for you guys to comment on what's going on and how well you like this lecture and so forth. Okay, so the first thing I want to cover tonight, it's the last topic that I didn't get to from lecture one. I'm bringing it over and covering it right now because I just wanted to make sure you understand, if you're debating this stuff with people, a standard thing for people who want to justify government intervention in healthcare and the health insurance industry in particular, is they're going to say, hey, Kenneth Arrow proved back in 1963 that the market doesn't work when it comes to either healthcare or health insurance, depending on how sophisticated the person is and what they'll say in particular. All right. And so if you want to see an example of that, that's why I gave you the Paul Krugman assigned reading for, I guess it would have been for week one in this course. So that's another thing. So I know some of you have never taken one of these classes before. There is a, besides this WebEx that you'll log into to see the live lectures, make sure you're also aware of going to academy.mises.org and logging into this particular course. There's a bunch of stuff there, including the links to all the various readings. So if you're not taking the course for credit, of course, you don't have to read that stuff, but a lot of it's good background information, and there's a lot of details in there in history that I can't cover in a general lecture. But if you're really interested in the details, you can go look at that stuff. So anyway, one of the things I included was one of Paul Krugman's early on, I think it was an editorial as opposed to an op-ed as opposed to a blog post, talking about these silly, naive, laissez-faire economists, and he would say, look it, you can't just wave your hand and say, invisible hand, you know, free markets, rah, 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 capitalism, and think that that's going to solve the healthcare, the problems in healthcare. Because that's, of course, where I'm coming from, and presumably many of you who signed up, that's your predisposition as well, is that when something is really screwed up in the world, particularly something involving commercial activities and that's provided by businesses, and there just seems to be this systematic problem that's not getting fixed for decades at a time, and clearly something is kind of screwy with the delivery of healthcare services in the United States, the natural reaction that I would have is to say, well, there's got to be some sort of government intervention that's causing this problem, because normally you would expect the profit and loss mechanism and competition in the private sector to get rid of something that's crazy. So, like, for example, with healthcare, I mean, what are the things that we are concerned about? Things like rising costs, and, you know, there's those articles floating around, maybe some of you have seen it, where some lady got a stitch and it cost her $500 or something like that, and that was after negotiation with the insurance. And so you see stuff like that, you say, that, well, that's crazy. That has to be somehow that the government is hindering competition, because clearly it doesn't cost $500 for someone to put a stitch in. That something's got to be systematically, institutionally wrong there. And so the way to fix that is to somehow get rid of the roadblocks that the government is introducing. So for this online course at Mises Academy, we will cover some of that stuff in either week three or probably, I guess, week four, the fourth lecture, the final lecture, whereas right now I'm still giving you the fundamentals and the groundwork for the details of Obamacare. All right, but so is a way to attack that type of argument that's sort of a, you know, generic, in general, whenever something's really screwy, I'm suspicious that the government is behind it, or at least is exacerbating it. Okay, so Krugman, and he's not alone in this, he's saying something that's typical in this particular debate, is saying, you guys can't make that move. This isn't a commodity like bread, or it's not like buying TVs at Best Buy, where, yeah, the market works pretty well in situations like that. No, there's something really special about healthcare, and that makes it not conducive to letting market forces just fix everything. And so that's why there is a role for government to come in and get involved. So just make sure you guys know that in general, the type of economists like Paul Krugman and people like that, they're not going to be so silly as to just come out and say, you know what, we hate freedom and we love big government busybodies, and it just warms our heart to see government spending go up. That's never the way he's going to couch his argument. Instead, he's always going to have some particular reason that, given the facts of this particular case, that's why more government involvement is a good thing. And it just so happens that he usually thinks that is the case, regardless of what the circumstances are. Krugman, 9 times out of 10, has always explained why it is that more government will make the situation better. Okay, so let me just run quickly, because I want you to understand the logic of the argument. This isn't just applicable to the specific case of healthcare and health insurance and Obamacare. It's, you see this, I would call it fallacy, all the time when you get into policy discussions involving economists. So I'm perhaps giving you more background than you need if you're just arguing with somebody at a dinner party or something like that, but I want you to understand exactly how it is that professional economists get so screwed up on this point. Okay, so in mainstream economics, they have these things that are called welfare theorems. And the word welfare in this context doesn't mean cash and other subsidies from the government that go to poor people. It means welfare in the sense like to provide for the general welfare, meaning like human well-being. That's what the term means here. And so what you can do is, using formal mathematical symbols, you can build a little model of an economy. And you can first of all ask, okay, if you had an omniscient, benevolent central planner, right? So somebody who had all the facts, and an omnipotent one too, right? So somebody who could just take all the resources in the economy, who knew everybody's preferences, knew all the technologies, knew what the supplies of various capital goods and labor and so forth were. So the central planner knows exactly what he has to work with and what his people would like. So he knows their preferences or their utility functions, if you want to get real technical about it. Okay, so you build a little model like that, and then you ask, what would the central planner's solution be? So how would the central planner use the scarce resources and the technology available to produce various types of goods and services and allocate them to his people? Okay, so when I say he's omnipotent, I don't mean he can take a loaf of bread and turn it into 50 loaves of bread just by thinking about it. What I mean is he can order people around and they do exactly what he says. It's not like you have to worry about people disobeying, okay? So that's what they call the central planner's solution or the planner's solution, and that's the ideal, right? They're saying this is theoretically the best we can do given the fact that there is scarcity and that, you know, we have limited technology, that we don't know how to get 7,000 miles per gallon gasoline right now. We physically don't know, or we just don't know how to do that. But given everything that our engineers do know, given everything the physicists know, the chemists, blah, 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 given the amount of coal and oil and fish in the ocean and all the other stuff we start out with, what should we do? And so you can go through and create various types of outcomes that are what's called Pareto optimal. You know what that term means. Okay. So then where the welfare theorems come in is they say, look, if you make a few assumptions about the way the world works or the structure of the world, it turns out that if you, instead of having the central planner just boss everybody around and say, you guys, you go make these many loaves of bread, you guys go make this many cars, you guys go do this and do that, instead of him just completely ordering the economy and reaching the theoretically best possible outcome, instead, what if we had a decentralized market system? So we have individual firms that are seeking not to promote the general welfare, but just to maximize their own profits, but they obey the rule of law. There's property rights. Okay, so you got individual firms that go into the market and they hire workers, pay them wages, they buy other resources at their various prices, and then they combine them to produce outputs that they sell at the prices that those outputs get in the retail markets. Okay, and then the consumers on their part, they get paid money as wages, or they get income because they're shareholders and own the firm, or they own resources like the coal mines and they sell the coal and they get the money that way. And then they have a budget constraint. And so given their preferences and their income, they go out in the marketplace and look around the available goods and services and spend the money that way in order to maximize their own individual utility or to get as high on their preference ranking as they can, given their budget constraint. Okay, so the welfare theorems say, under these types of assumptions, it turns out that the decentralized market outcome, where each firm is just looking to maximize profit, each household has a budget constraint and then goes and maximizes its own personal utility, subject to, you know, its budget, the outcome is something that the central planner might pick. So it's like saying, there's a sense in which the market economy can duplicate the outcome that an omniscient, omnipotent, benevolent central planner would order everybody to do if, you know, he knew all the relevant information and really just wanted to do what was best for us. Okay, so I'm leaving a lot of complications to the story because there's an infinite number of possible outcomes that are optimal in the way we're using the term here. Okay, but the point is there's going to be no waste. There's not going to be any really stupid outcome where we could clearly improve and make everybody better off. All right. So that's the type of thing the welfare theorems do. So it's basically, if you know about Adam Smith and his argument about the invisible hand, where Smith famously said, I'm paraphrasing, but it's, you know, it's not out of the individual shopkeeper's concern for others that he delivers things, but for his, you know, looking at after his own well-being. And then he's got the famous passage where he says people are led as if by, or sorry, led by an invisible hand to promote the general welfare. Again, I'm paraphrasing that. Those weren't his exact words. But that's where that phrase now that we use a lot, the invisible hand, comes from, that Adam Smith used in a few spots. Okay, so the idea there is like, huh, even though no individual is trying to help others, even though everybody is maybe selfish in a certain sense of that term, nonetheless, embedded in the framework and the institutions of a market economy with private property guided by price signals, look it. And we can do it formally. You can do it with math. And that's what the beauty of this is and why it's kind of a neat result that they came up with, you know. So it wasn't just in words. It wasn't just a bunch of British classical economists writing nice tributes to the market economy in prose. No, it was economists, mathematical economists in the 20th century who rigorously wrote out equations describing a little hypothetical economy, and then they proved mathematically, look at the decentralized market outcome mimics what the central planner's optimal solution would be. Okay, so it's kind of a neat thing just to study, but there's a problem. There was a dangerous rhetorical trap that this set for proponents of laissez-faire is that, in other words, they were showing sufficient conditions. Let me see if I can type that in here. Oops. Hang on, I gotta make the font bigger, unless you guys have supervision. Sorry, still not big enough. Okay. They showed sufficient conditions, if you're familiar with that term. Okay, but they weren't necessary conditions. Okay, so in other words, they were showing, look at, if we assume that all consumers have perfect information, if we assume that all the products are identical in a certain respect within a given industry, if we assume that everyone's a price taker, that no firm thinks it can influence the price by enlarging or shrinking its output. So you list a bunch of conditions like that, and then out pops the result. We can, you know, if you give me those conditions, then I can prove to you that therefore the market economy does just as well as even an omniscient, omnipotent, benevolent central planner. So the idea is we can go ahead and just leave it up to the market if we have those conditions satisfied, because we can prove mathematically, let a central planner come in and start tinkering isn't going to fix anything or isn't going to prove it, right? But again, the rhetorical danger with that was, oh, well, shoot, what if in the real world the actual market doesn't exactly satisfy all of those assumptions we had to make to get our mathematical proof to work? Then they say, oh, see, so now the welfare theorems don't hold, and that opens the door for government intervention. See, because we can't prove mathematically that the market outcome is exactly what a central planner would have done. Okay, so that's the intellectual framework from which these economists are then addressing real-world policy issues. So, like I say, it's, when you see the proof of it, if you're good with math and you're not afraid of math and you like looking at stuff like that, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's a surprisingly powerful result. But like I said, rhetorically, it actually kind of backfired, because by saying under these conditions, we can guarantee mathematically that the market outcome is optimal in some sense of that term, that sort of left the door open then for people to say, oh, well, if you don't have those conditions, then it blows up in the face. Okay, so in that milieu, this guy Kenneth Arrow, who, by the way, he's he's huge. He's a giant in terms of economic theory. You guys may have heard of, he had this famous result called Arrow's Impossibility Theorem. So that had nothing to do with healthcare. But this, I'm just pointing out, this is the same guy. All right, and that's a pretty neat result too. And that comes up a lot in discussions of voting mechanisms and stuff like that. So the impossibility means he showed you can't have a system, a rule that takes all the citizens' preferences and then sort of merges them into a social preference. That you can't come up with a framework for doing that that satisfies various criteria that all seem pretty intuitive and just. And so it's kind of, so the story goes, when he was working on that in grad school, there's all kinds of possible ways you could do social choice. There's also the way that the group could come up with ways to take collective action. Like you could have a majority rule, you could have every year just pick one person randomly from the phone book and make them a dictator. There's all sorts of rules you could use to figure out how is it that the group is going to decide things collectively, where each individual has some input into the answer. And so Arrow, so the story goes, wanted to just kind of start weeding out ridiculous rules. You know, like rules that say, let's just pick somebody and make him dictator forever. He wanted to say, well, no, I'm going to rule out any system that relies upon establishing a dictator. Okay? So that's one condition. And then he just went through and listed very weak conditions. Like another one was, if every single person in society thinks that A is better than B, where those are two possible choices that the group could make, well, then it better not be that our rule somehow makes the group choose B over A. And so that was like a unanimity rule. But if everyone unanimously agrees A is better than B, then our decision rule better not give us the opposite. Okay, so he listed a bunch of things like that just to kind of weed out the stupid possible mechanisms by which the group would make decisions. And then he realized he was left with the empty set. And so that's why they call it the impossibility theorem, that showed there's no social rule. It's impossible to come up with a rule that satisfies all of these what at first glance are pretty intuitive things. Okay, anyway, I kind of went off on a tangent there, but that's an amazing result. And so all the proponents of democracy just kind of ignore that. And say, oh, well, yeah, he kind of just blew up our whole world, but we're going to move on because we like democracy. Anyway, back to what he showed with healthcare. In 1963, he came out with a paper, and this is, if you're curious, I put it in the readings for the week one, but keep in mind, I just told you in the annotations there, the instructions, I pointed you to specific sections. It's a really big paper, and at times it gets technical, so I zoomed in on where you want to go just to skim to see the arguments as he laid them out, and then you can see how Krugman paraphrased. But anyway, he just walked through and showed several respects in which the market for healthcare did not satisfy the standard assumption that economic theory would use when trying to establish the viability or the desirability of market provision. Okay, so the way Krugman summarizes Arrow's result or his arguments from the 63 paper, Krugman picked two main things. So Arrow listed a bunch of stuff. Krugman kind of boiled it down to two main issues. And this is why Krugman said, look at the market for bread or TVs or bicycles, microwave ovens, things like that is far different from the market for healthcare. So yeah, we're not a bunch of socialist commies. We agree that markets work pretty well in general, and we don't want the government to micromanage everything, but come on, there's fundamental things or attributes of the healthcare market that make it not suitable for pure laissez-faire. Okay, so the two things he put his finger on was he saying, look, because of the nature of certain healthcare expenditures where they're unpredictable and they're very expensive. Okay, so some stuff is regular and predictable and cheap, just going and getting a physical, if you get a cold or if you get some kind of infection or something, going to get an antibiotics, whatever. That kind of stuff. Some of the crewman's talking about, and Arrow was talking about really big ticket items that you have a heart attack or a stroke, or you get diagnosed with cancer, stuff like that, where when you're at the outset of your life, you don't know if you're going to get hit with those expenses or when. And when they do happen, they're really expensive and you might not be able to afford it. You might not have enough in your checking account. So Krugman's saying, because of all that, that's why healthcare needs to rely on third-party payers, namely insurance companies, if you're going to allow market provision. That you're not just going to have individuals on their own paying directly for healthcare because of what I just walked through, that you have these infrequent but possibly catastrophic expenses that you can't really plan for. You just know there's a chance I might get hit. So just remember, in the week one's lecture, I walked you guys through the logic of just insurance in general, not just health insurance, but just in general, why do we have insurance in a market economy? And it was precisely for that reason. I said there are certain things that people know there's a chance they're going to have to pay, and it's going to be catastrophic if they do get hit with it, but they might not have to pay it. And so in that type of scenario, it makes sense for a company to offer to cover you or cover those expenses if they do occur, and in exchange you pay a guaranteed premium. Okay, and so that's the way everybody kind of pools the risks, and we all collectively pay the total damages so that no individual has to bear the damage individually and where it's catastrophic. Okay, so Krugman is right that, yeah, okay, healthcare is a type of situation where it makes sense for there to be insurance. And so then Krugman says, and so this introduces a problem, and this is one reason that the market for healthcare doesn't work as well as the market for bread or for TVs. That here, because now what happens is you actually aren't the one paying the bill. It's the insurance company. And so now they're going to come on the scene. They're going to stand in between you and the healthcare provider, and they're going to try to contain their costs. And so it's not, and the insurance company doesn't have your best interest in heart. The insurance company is there to run a business, to make profit. And so they're going to, quibble about costs. If your doctor says you need a certain treatment, the insurance company might say, well, no, we don't think so. We disagree. We're not paying for that. Right? So Krugman's saying that already we see a major reason that just saying, oh, let the free market take care of it is naive and foolish because of this issue right here, that you need to have third-party payers. And so you as the individual don't have as much control over what's happening. Okay, so that's one thing. And then another major issue is that the purchases are infrequent, and then when they do happen, the individual consumer typically is not in a position to judge the quality of what happened, right? So we can trust competition to work with loaves of bread or buying a TV or something like that, or eating in a certain restaurant, because you can buy the TV, you can figure out pretty soon whether it works or not, and if you don't like it, then you don't need to buy from that company anymore. You don't need to go to that particular store that stocks the shelves with that brand. Or especially going out to eat, if you thought the food at that place was terrible, I mean, unless you actually get food poisoning and die, the worst that happens is you're out the money you spent for that meal. And then you just know, okay, I'm never going there again. And so, so the note is there that if it's something that happens a lot, because you go out to eat a lot, there's a lot of people that, you go through a lot of TVs, whatever, then, yeah, competition works pretty well to keep the suppliers honest and to make sure they're doing what they can to keep their customers happy and to keep costs down, keep prices down. But Krugman's saying when it comes to health care, when it comes to like getting a triple bypass surgery, it's not like you can say, well, yeah, I got a triple bypass surgery at this hospital last month and I didn't care for it. I don't think they did a great job. So next month, I get another triple bypass. I'm going to go down the street and try his other plate. You see what I'm saying? He's saying, no, stuff like that, competition really doesn't work as well as it would with things like buying bread or going out to dinner. Okay? And then, so, Krugman has argued, and he just kind of then jumped to the conclusion, so this is why the market doesn't work, and therefore, the government should get involved. And you apostles of laissez-faire and just idiots and naive for ignoring the reality of this staring you in the face. Okay, so I think you guys probably all can see where I'm going with this because I kept hammering home what they're arguing with. You can see the flaw. Let me just give you the analogy, and then I'll reverse the slide and go specifically over his 2 points again. So I was trying to think of a better analogy. This is the best one I could come up with. You guys could probably improve upon it. You'll see where I'm going with it. It's like someone saying, oh, yeah, sure. For a small fire, throwing water on it, that works pretty well to put it out. But, you know, if the fire really gets out of hand, like your whole kitchen's on fire, just taking buckets of water and throwing it on it, that might not work very well. So that's why you should go ahead and get buckets of gasoline and throw that on the kitchen fire. Okay, so again, I tried to pick something outlandish just to see the fallacy involved. Just because, you know, if you're trying to choose between two ways of dealing with something, water and gasoline to deal with a fire, just because you're saying the case for water is not as strong as it was from scenario one to scenario two, it doesn't follow that therefore the case for using gasoline just got better. You would first of all have to see, well, in general, why is the water better than the gasoline? And then does that advantage, even if the advantage shrinks, maybe it doesn't flip. But the reason I picked gasoline is having a bigger fire makes throwing gasoline even worse. Okay, so in other words, the very factors that make water not as good idea or not as effective also make gasoline even worse. That the bigger the fire, the even crazier it would be to throw more gasoline on it. Okay, whereas if you had like a match and threw a bucket of gasoline on it, that actually wouldn't be catastrophic. Okay, so let's back up a slide and you'll see what I'm talking about. Remember, Krugman's 2 main points are he's saying, look, you have to rely on third-party payers and you can't trust insurance companies to keep your best interest at heart. Okay, yeah, I mean, we don't need to fight that. We can say, sure, the shareholders of a health insurance company, I will admit, do not care about my health as much as I do, or they don't care as much about my kid getting better as I do. Fair enough. You know, I'd be foolish to deny that. But how does it follow, therefore, we should have the government get involved? You see the fallacy there? That's crazy. The people in Washington, D.C. certainly don't care more about my kid than I do. And if we're talking about breaking down the power of competition, because instead of all the consumers being out there day in and day out with their payment decisions sort of penalizing bad hospitals or bad doctors and rewarding the good ones, yes, we can admit that the competitive forces and that kind of market perhaps don't work as well as they would in a market like for restaurants. Fair enough, but how then does switching to government provision fix that? There's even less competition when the government comes in and starts taking stuff over. Okay, and then the issue of, well, the consumers can't judge. Okay, but what Krugman has in mind there is that it's the bureaucrats are in a better position to judge. But strictly speaking, he's leaving out the whole issue of how we're controlling the bureaucrats. And so really the issue is, okay, if the consumers aren't smart enough to judge it and they can't figure out whether a doctor is good or bad, yet they're qualified to go vote for the right politicians who are then qualified to make sure the right bureaucrats are in charge, who will then have the expertise to only give their seal of approval to certain medical practices or providers that they think are reputable. Okay, you see the problem. So Krugman's leaving out a whole lot to the argument, and in fact, I would say the very reasons he's citing for why the free market might not work as well in healthcare as it does with TVs also shows why government doesn't work as well in healthcare as it would if you had the government monopolize the production of TVs. Okay, so just think about, maybe that might be a better way of thinking about it. The citizens would have better control over government socialized TV production than they do over government provided healthcare. Because everybody can tell whether the TVs that the government's making are good or bad. You can tell that pretty fast. You can plug it in and see if it works or not. Whereas if you get some sort of preventive surgery done from a government provided health clinic, it might not be as obvious to you whether they did a good job. If somebody dies during a heart surgery from government provided services, you as a citizen can't really tell, oh, is that because the government doctor botched it or was it just a really tough case? You don't know. And so by the same token, having the government take over more of healthcare is even crazier than having the government take over TV production. Okay, so let me move on now. Let me give you a brief historical overview here. Again, with the time constraints I have and the stuff I want to talk to you guys about, I don't think my comparative advantage is in giving you a whole history, but I do want to just, in case some of you are just listening to these lectures, I want to make sure there's certain things you know about. So you probably have all heard of what's called, or at least in the United States, what's called Blue Cross Blue Shield. Like that's a major health insurance provider at this point. Well, historically where that came from was Blue Cross was an association of hospitals. So that was like an intermediate group that, you know, people who would go to get treated in hospitals would go through Blue Cross. So that, you know, that was an independent or an organization standing in between the consumer and the hospital providers of services. And then Blue Shield was on the physician side. Okay, and then they actually merged in 1982 into Blue Cross Blue Shield. Okay, so in the article, if you want to see more of the details, it's from John Goodman, and I assigned it for week one. Yeah, week one, where he talks about health insurance in the United States. He gets into a little bit, but he points out that in the post-war era, meaning after World War II, partly because of various state government interventions in the market, Blue Cross and Blue Shield sort of became the dominant insurance provider. And it was Blue Cross and Blue Shield that had the attributes that we now just take for granted as the way health insurance works in the United States. Things like paying for cost plus payments. And so like the hospital would just say, well, this is how much it costs. And they'd say, oh, okay. As opposed to just giving a certain amount for the results. Okay. So if you want to go look at there. So there, in terms of explaining how did we get into this predicament in the first place? Why is it that there's such an outcry for the government to do something about healthcare and health insurance? Part of the understanding of how did things get so screwed up is, I think, looking at the history of how Blue Cross and Blue Shield, through various state interventions, managed to move what the standard practice was in the industry in ways that now, at least in retrospect, we can say, yeah, that really severs the ability for, or severs the connection between the consumer and the provider. So again, just to go back, what Krugman and Arrow were putting their finger on is true insofar as it goes. Like if you're trying to understand, how can it be that hospitals can get away with charging so much for things? Part of the answer is that you're not paying for it out of pocket. And so when you go, you know, if you have to schedule an operation, since your insurance is going to cover most of it, depending on your plan, you're not so concerned about the cost. Whereas in other areas of your life, when you're booking some major thing, you certainly are going to want to know what the price is. Whereas, you know, I can just tell you when the doctor, when my son's physician says, oh, yeah, you know, he needs to go have a specialist look at such and such. You don't ask, well, how, I mean, you could ask how much it's going to cost. And sometimes I do because I had a plan with a high deductible, but it just, the culture is not like that. People for some reason think that, oh no, when it comes to medical care, you can't worry about price. But I'm saying partly why people think like that is because they're not actually paying the price directly. They're doing it indirectly through the premiums. Okay. And so to understand how did we get to this position, seeing some of these interventions is useful. Okay, just a distinction, make sure you know the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. Medicare is kind of like healthcare along the Social Security model, where everybody is eligible once, if you get past a certain age, or if you have certain things that happen to you, you can become eligible earlier, and you pay your very reasonable premiums, and then you get all these benefits, and the government pays for yours. So it's like the government acting as the health insurance company for millions upon millions of elderly Americans. So like I said, I found a figure that 49.4 million people were on Medicare in 2012. Okay, whereas Medicaid is strictly intended for low-income people. And so that's what's called means-tested. So the difference there, Social Security, even if you're wealthy, everybody gets Social Security retirement benefits. Right? That's not a program designed for the needy. Whereas not everybody gets food stamps. Or you see what I'm saying? So that's what Medicaid is, also for health care, but it's designed for poorer people who can't afford it on their own, whereas Medicare is something that everybody in theory is going to go through. Just like everybody basically is going to get Social Security as part of their pension, if you will. All right? So already we can see, when you're trying to understand the healthcare industry, why is it so like this, the government already plays a humongous role in the provision of healthcare in the United States. So it's not like Obamacare dipping its toe into this area. It's just an expansion. Okay. Also, this thing, HMO, health maintenance organizations, these they've been around for a while. Like, they even had them as far back as 1980, perhaps probably even earlier. But there were like something like, I saw a figure about fewer than 10 million people were enrolled in an HMO in the early 80s, and now it's a much more prominent thing. So what was going on is, think of it from the point of view of the insurance company, the health insurance company. They can see as well as we can the problems that they're insuring people, the individual, their clients, their policyholders, the people who have health insurance, are going to go out and they're not watching costs. Right. Every time they get sick, they're going to rush to the emergency room, but they're going to go to the doctor or whatever. And so running up the big bills. And so then the health insurance company knows, okay, well, shoot, we got to charge higher premiums. But if we make the premiums too expensive, then people aren't going to want to buy our insurance policy in the first place. They're just going to pay out of pocket. So one of their remedies was to form these things called HMOs. And if you remember, there was that famous scene with in a movie As Good As It Gets with Jack Nicholson and what's her name, Helen Hunt, I think so, where she says effing HMO, but she didn't say effing, she said the dirty word. Okay, and so that was, I mean, so that, what don't Americans like about HMO? It's that, oh my gosh, there's all these restrictions on what I can do. I can only go to certain doctors. If I go out of network, then I get hit with huge bills and so forth. But from the insurer's perspective, they had to do stuff like that. That given that they're on the hook, they had to start limiting and saying, you can't just go to any doctor. We're going to have to go out and pick certain doctors that we have a relationship with and that our people go and check out. We think we're not totally getting overcharged for standard treatment, stuff like that. Okay. So it's sort of unavoidable. You can't just have a blank check. In that respect. So it's, I guess one way to see what's going on here is something like fire insurance, there the only thing is like fire insurance for your house. The only thing the insurance company really needs to worry about is like arson. You know, sometimes people might just deliberately burn their house down to, you know, if, like, let's say it's way underwater or something. You know, that might, it might financially make sense for them to burn their house down and get more money than it's worth or something like that. Or they need to worry about people being too careless, like someone smoking cigarettes on the couch and falling asleep and setting the house on fire. And so they'll put in things like that, and they may charge a higher premium if you are a smoker. They may have stipulations like you have to have smoke alarms. You got to have, you know, if it's a commercial building, you got to have a sprinkler system. You got to have a contract with the fire department that an alarm system that notifies them immediately if a fire is detected so they can get down there. Things like that. So that's the kind of thing you need to worry. But generally speaking, they don't need to worry so much about people constantly getting their house on fire and then submitting frivolous claims. See what I'm saying? That's not really an issue. Whereas if you're covering people for health care, different types of people have all sorts of reasons for going and getting various treatment if they're only paying actually, you know, a small copay, or if they're only paying like an out-of-pocket thing, or if they're paying like 20% or what have you. Okay, so that's the fundamental thing. The very reason you want to have insurance, so that if you get hit with a big medical bill, you don't have to pay for all of it, is the very reason that now the insurance company has an interest in limiting what you do. Okay, so there is that fundamental tension there. And the point is, there's various possible ways of resolving it. So I would just jump to my conclusion and say, well, let the market decide. And there could be different types of plans. Okay, but I'm just explaining that's the logic of it. Okay, let me run through a basic timeline here. I think what I'm going to do, especially based on your guys' questions, because I know some of you have really particular subtle ones. Like I say, this lecture, I'm kind of going over the big picture for those of you who just, you've been hearing about it in the news and you just wanted to tune into somebody who tells you a lot of the big picture specifics. In further lectures, we can get more precise about particular elements of this. Okay, but big picture, so it was on March 23rd, 2010 that he signed what was technically called the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. So you will often see it abbreviated as the ACA, just for Affordable Care Act. And of course, a lot of people just refer to it as Obamacare. Okay, on October 1st of this year is when the open enrollment period began. So that's when people can start signing up for the health exchanges, either provided by the states or the federal government. By the way, for this particular lecture, I'm not getting into those distinctions. I will cover that next lecture because there's just a lot of material and I want to squeeze it in. Okay, but if you're wondering about, yeah, what the heck is going on? I know some states opted in, some states opted out. Some people can go to their state website. Other people have to go to healthcare.gov. What the heck is going on? We're going to cover at least the basics of that next week. Okay, so then on January 1st of 2014, coming up, that's when the coverage actually begins for people who have signed up for the government-provided health exchanges. Okay, that's also when the individual mandate kicks in. Okay, so now, you know, in the year 2014 is when I think technically it's they settle up with you at the end of the year. But the point is, if you don't have health insurance and you're not exempt, and in the next slide we're going to go over some of the rules for what that means, then this is when it starts. Okay, so if you're young and don't have health insurance, and that was one of the reasons you signed up for this course, is you want to kind of see that. Hang on, the next slide we'll get to the specifics of that. Okay, and then here I'm going to touch on somebody asked me a question in week one, so if you're tuned in, you'll at least hear the answer. So on March 1st, 2014, that's when open enrollment closes. Okay, so open enrollment for this period started back in October, and of course everybody's freaking out because healthcare.gov didn't work. and then open enrollment closes on March 1st, 2014. From that point forward, you cannot sign up at the government exchanges. All right, you can go and buy an individual policy yourself. And if you go get if you change jobs or something, then you're going to be and you're a full-time employee and the employer has more than 50 employees, you're going to be on the employer's plan. But the point is, you can't just go to healthcare.gov and sign up on March 2nd, 2014. Except if you have a major life event that occurs. Okay, so if you get divorced, you have a kid, and then some other things like that, then you can sign up. Now, there is another enrollment period down the line. Okay? So it's if you don't sign up here, it's not like for the rest of your life you can no longer sign up at Obamacare or for Obamacare at healthcare.gov. But the point is, you can't do it in 2014. You've got to wait until the next open enrollment period. So, I'll talk a little bit more about that stuff too, because that's a little bit tricky and there's a lot of nuances. So I will come back to that. But this answers the question, somebody was saying, well, what if I'm healthy right now? Can I just not sign up and just pay the fee? And then if I get sick though, well, then the next, once I find out I have cancer, the next day I'll go and sign up. There's, strictly speaking, you can't literally do that, but I'll talk more about that in the next court, because it's part of the problem here. I know I'm bouncing around, but I'm just trying to get you guys to see why it's really tricky teaching this course and for me to go research and boil stuff down for you. Is, on the one hand, you got to kind of rely on what's in the actual legislation to say what the rules are, but on the other hand, as an economist, you can kind of see, well, wait a minute, that's not possibly going to work like that. And so I'm going to constantly be sort of torn when I want to explain to you how is this going to play out between, well, here's officially what they say versus here's what's actually going to happen. Okay, so what I'm saying is, officially, they're saying, no, you can't just not sign up and then when you get cancer or whatever, get in a car accident on the way to the hospital, say to the guy driving the ambulance, oh my God, here's my smartphone, log me into healthcare.gov. They're saying you can't do that, but we'll see in practice what ends up happening, because it wouldn't surprise me if there are cases like that and then the government ends up retroactively enrolling the person or something. Okay, so we'll talk more about that next time. Okay, oops, sorry, I'll talk about the mandate in the next slide, but let's go over this right now. Okay, so here's, if you read my article, Economics of Obamacare, this is all review for the next 10 minutes or so here, but some people haven't read that article, so I don't want to leave them out. So here are some of the major components of what we know of as Obamacare. Okay, so first of all, it offers universal coverage, meaning that anybody can go and get health insurance, regardless of pre-existing conditions and other factors like that. The plans have to have minimum standards. The insurance companies have to engage in what's called community rating when they're setting the premiums for their plans. And what community rating means, let me type this in, is that it's based only on age and geography, not health or sex. Okay, so they're allowed to charge a higher premium for health insurance to somebody who's 64 than for somebody who's 22. And they're allowed to charge a different premium for somebody who lives in Brooklyn than for somebody who lives in Boise, Idaho. All right? So the idea is they can create various communities of people who differ only on their age and geographical location. And I don't know, to be honest with you, one thing that would be interesting is to see how finely can they make those geographical distinctions, because I bet you there's rules about that. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if they're not allowed to say, well, you live in Compton, so we're going to charge you a much higher premium than somebody who lives in, you know, a little bit 3 miles away, because it's not as likely you're going to get shot, right? Because that would sound kind of racist, right? So I don't know exactly, when they say it can be based on geography, I don't know how coarse or fine that is. I will look into that. But in particular, what they're not allowed to do is say, because you're a woman, you know, so if you have two 25-year-olds and one's female and one's male, you can't charge the woman more. All right. And so why that's an issue is, at least for certain age brackets, women might be expected to have higher medical expenses. You know, for one thing, women might get pregnant. All right. So that's a big issue in all of this, and why certain people are going to get hit. You know, effectively, you know, I see people complaining, that young guys complaining, that basically, you know, oh my gosh, I have to pay for insurance now that will cover me in case I get pregnant. You know, they'll be complaining like that. So there is a germ of truth in that sort of complaint. Okay. Another big plank in this is what they call the employer mandate. So the employers have to provide health insurance to their employees, but the mandate is only applicable if the firm has 50 or more full-time employees, and full-time means that the employee works 30 plus hours per week. Okay. And then the other major component to all this is the individual mandate, which, like I said, kicks in on January 1st, 2014. Okay, so before moving on, let me just explain the logic of all this and why these things all mesh or fit together. Why you kind of have to, given that you're going to do something like Obamacare, these things all had to be included, or things like them. Okay, so the first, the obvious one is the universal coverage. That's what everybody wanted. That, and by the way, somebody had emailed me and asked this question. Let me answer it right now. Somebody had asked me saying, you know, I don't understand, what is it true that in the free market, or sorry, in the market, there were all these millions of people that were uninsured, and why, you know, so, because the person had been arguing with his buddies or whatever, people on the internet, about Obamacare, and he didn't quite understand, you know, why is there this problem? I don't understand. Okay, so yes, the ostensible problem is, there really are millions of people before the passage of this law who do not have health insurance. Now, the typical way that a proponent of the ACA or Obamacare will explain why that is they'll say, oh, because either they have a pre-existing condition, or they just don't have enough money, and the greedy health insurance companies are charging ridiculous premiums to them. And so that's why. Okay, so is that really the reality, and why was that happening in the market? Well, it was, given the way the institutional design is, yes, that was happening, and we can talk about what would be a better way to address that issue rather than having the government get even more involved. But to understand why could that be the case, well, one thing is, of those millions and millions of people who are uninsured, a lot of them, it's not like they were sick. Right, it's not that there were millions and millions of people walking around who all had brain tumors and so forth, or clogged arteries, and that's why, and the insurance companies were saying, no, absolutely not, we're not going to offer you any coverage. That wasn't the whole explanation. A lot of it was young, healthy people who saw how much health insurance was going to be and said, no, I'm just going to risk it. Instead of me paying those outrageous premiums, I'm just going to hope I don't get sick. And if I do get sick, well, you know, maybe my parents will help me, or I'll dip into my savings, or hey, I'll just go and stick it to the taxpayer. You know, but so that's part of the issue here. That a lot of those millions of people who weren't covered, they were healthy. It's not like they were dying in the streets. It's that they were just taking a gamble. Okay, and then, but for people with pre-existing conditions, here gets a little trickier. Like I explained to you guys in week one, I do know of cases where insurance companies were truly just saying, no, we're not going to even offer a policy to somebody because the kid has a problem with his heart or something. Okay, and like I said, I speculated that that might have been because they were afraid that even if you tried to give to craft a policy that contractually said, oh, no, you don't have to cover for this particular thing, but just in general, in case we get in a car accident or something, that they would be afraid a court wouldn't enforce that. Right? Because you would think in general, why couldn't somebody still get catastrophic coverage for stuff not related to whatever the pre-existing condition is? You know, why couldn't they do that, at least? And I think it's because they probably were worried that if something did happen to you and you had insurance for people, you know, the court in a lawsuit, they might not uphold. So just like, you know what, let's not even take this person onto our roles because then we're just asking for trouble down the road. Okay. The other issue is for certain people with pre-existing conditions, like, you know, somebody who has cancer, you know, so somebody didn't have health insurance and then gets diagnosed with cancer and then tries to go and get health insurance in a regular market environment. Strictly speaking, the insurance company might say, well, okay, we'll offer you a policy, but we'll have to charge you $18,000 a month in premiums for a person. You know, if we just restricted the policies to people like you to break even, we would have to charge each of you $18,000 a month because chances are pretty soon you're going to end up going to the hospital and we're going to have to write out a check for hundreds of thousands of dollars for your treatment. Okay, so I'm making up numbers, but you get the idea there that certain people, whether the insurance company literally told them, no, we're not going to offer you a policy, or whether they just knew it's pointless for us to offer a policy because if we did, the amount we would need to charge, given your risk characteristics, is ridiculous. It comes to the same thing. Okay. Okay, so given that was the issue, that there's a bunch of people walking around without coverage, and that's what people wanted to fix. And by the way, just so you know, just you don't misstep in an argument or something, you got to be careful about saying, oh my gosh, if we have universal coverage, we're all going to be goose-stepping under the Fuhrer within 36 months. Because then they're going to come back and say, you moron, every major country right now except the U.S., or every advanced country, whatever sort of politically incorrect term to use, has universal coverage. And so they'll say that the U.S. is the outlier here, we're the dinosaurs. Okay, so again, in week four, lecture four, we'll tackle that issue specifically about the international comparisons. But they're saying we want to have universal coverage. So that's what they wanted to do. But my point is, you can't just do that first bullet point here. You couldn't just pass a law saying, okay, from now on, it's illegal for an insurance company to deny an applicant health insurance. Because if that's all the law said, well, then the insurance companies would come back and say, okay, fair enough, President Obama. Some guy with cancer comes up and says, I'd like a health plan, please. And he says, sure thing, here you go, this plan will provide up to $100 in health expenses per year, and we will charge you $100 premium. Okay, where do you want to sign? You see that, yeah, technically that's a health insurance plan, that it offers benefits and it takes premiums, but that's clearly stupid. All right, so that's where the second bullet point comes in. Given that you're going to force the insurance companies to offer plans to everybody, they had to put in place floors, minimum standards to say, these are the type of plans you have to offer. Because it's an empty guarantee. You can go get health insurance, but the plan you get delivered isn't very good. Okay. Another thing if that's all it did, if they said, okay, every plan you offer has to cover, you know, has to pay up to $1 million in expenses. It has to cover childbirth. It has to cover plastic surgery. It has to cover contraception, blah, 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 whatever. Oh, wow, that's a really comprehensive plan. Okay. But that wouldn't be enough either to do what these people had in mind, because then the insurance companies would say, okay, they would tinker with everything. And then if you came up and you were healthy and applied for that nice minimum standard plan, or plan that met those minimum standards, and you were healthy, and they say, okay, yeah, $100 a month. And if you came in and applied for that and you had cancer, they would say, okay, for you, this same plan is $18,000 a month. You see, we're offering them a good plan. It has all these benefits. It's just the premium is a lot higher because, you know, it's got cancer. So that's why this third bullet point was necessary. They said, no, you can't tailor the premium to the individual based on everything you know about them. You can only make the premium vary according to the individual's age and geographical location. But you can't do it based on their health status or whether they're a male or a female. Okay, so you see the logic there. That given what they're trying to do, they had to have that kind of requirement in there, because otherwise the insurance company just would have adapted to the law and it would have been stupid from everybody's perspective. Okay, as far as the employer mandate, there it's not as obvious as the other stuff I just walked through. There, my understanding is it was that most Americans were getting their health coverage from their employer, and the people doing Obamacare didn't want to screw with that, because they were afraid. They made it look like they were telling every American, your plan is going to get upended, that people would have revolted. They wanted to make it look like, no, we're not messing with the vast majority of people's plans. All we're doing is offering more. We're just tweaking the system a little bit to be able to give coverage to these millions of Americans who don't have it. But for all the vast majority of you who have your plan and like it, you can keep it. Right? That's where they're coming from. Okay, so that's what the employer mandate was for. And then the reason for the 50 or more full-time or the 30 hours per week is they wanted to make sure that there was no how can I put it? It would have been crazy to put this big employer mandate on a really small firm. They thought, okay, even the Obama administration acknowledged that would be too onerous of a burden for really small businesses. And then also, they wanted to make sure that you weren't being required to give your health insurance to somebody who was just coming in and sweeping the floors once a week. Okay, I see you guys are talking about audio problems. Unfortunately, I'm not sure what I can do to address that. On my end, it's broadcast. Is it better now? Okay, yeah, sorry. Okay. Okay, so that, and then finally, the individual mandate. There it was. The logic of all this is the only way it's going to work, because what's going to happen is now the insurance companies have to provide coverage. They got to provide a certain type of plan to everybody of a minimum quality, and they're not allowed to discriminate in terms of the conditions. Okay, so now the mandate is necessary as a component in order to get everybody, to get enough people into the pool to make the whole thing financially viable. Because you obviously can't just say, sorry, I see you guys are complaining about the audio. Unfortunately, like I say, I'm not sure what I can do with this, and I've done everything I can to maximize the connection. Since we're almost out of time, why don't we just try to get through this, and I'll try to troubleshoot and do something better for next time. So for the individual mandate, it's you got to get people into the pool, right? Because if you didn't do that, if you did all the first four bullet points that I said there, and you didn't do the fifth bullet point, the danger would be if all of these people with pre-existing conditions come in, and now the average type of policyholder is much more expensive now, then they would have to jack up the premiums, and then nobody would be able to afford it. Okay, we could sort of just drown it out, and it would be a vicious downward spiral where the more expensive the premiums got, fewer people would sign up, in particular the healthy people. And so then it would just get worse and worse over time, where just the really sick people would sign up for the insurance. And then the whole thing would collapse. It wouldn't work anymore. So the way to deal with that is to force all the healthy people to sign up too. So if you have enough healthy people in the pool, it keeps the average expense down. So from the insurance company's point of view, it's affordable. You know, that they can stay in business. Okay, let's talk a little bit about this individual mandate. So the Orwellian title they gave this thing, and if you go to healthcare.gov and read about it, this is what they'll say. They'll say, they'll call it the individual shared responsibility fee. All right, so that should just give you the chills right there. That's what they're calling it. And so I don't have this in the slide, but that was ruled as technically it was a tax by the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court challenge. Okay, so it's based on the number of months that you don't have coverage during a given year, and it starts on January 1st. Okay, what I've shown here is the schedule for what that fee is, or that tax is, if you don't get insurance and you're an individual. So remember, if you have a job with an employer that has more than 50 or more employees, and that's and you're a full-time employee, well then you're going to get your health care from the employer. But like if you're self-employed or you're unemployed or whatever, or you're just not working, or you work for a business that is exempt from the employer mandate, then the issue, you know, the deal is it's up to you to go get health insurance for yourself. Now, you're exempt from these penalties if your income, if what you make is below 133% of the federal poverty law. So make sure you realize that when you see some of these numbers, okay? So, but if you make over 133% of the federal poverty line, then these numbers apply to you. I mean, I think there's a few other exemptions, like if you're Amish or something, you might be exempt from something like that. But in general, this is what applies to the people who are not going to be able to get it from the employer. Okay, so in 2014, it's pretty low. It's only $95 per person per year, or 1% of their income, whichever is higher. So I actually shouldn't have said it's pretty low. I mean, depending 1%, that's actually a big tax. But I'm saying that the flat number, that doesn't sound so bad, $95. Okay. But then look what happens in 2015. It jumps to $325 a person and then doubles to 2% of your income. And in 2016, it goes up to $695 a person per year, by the way. This isn't just a flat fee forever. This is each year you don't have it, that's what you pay. Or 2.5% of your income, whichever is higher. And then from 2017 forward, the flat number increases with the rate of price inflation, but the percentage of your income is capped. Okay, so again, what they're saying is, this is what the individual mandate is. They're saying if you do not have health insurance and you're not exempt for these various according to these various loopholes, such as if you don't make at least 133% of the federal poverty line, then this is what you have to pay as a tax to the federal government to not have health insurance. So on the one hand, you might wonder, well, why the heck would anybody not sign up for it? Well, it depends on what the price is going to be. Depends what the premiums are going to be. Right? So in next week, we're going to talk about some of the estimates of what the premium will be. And already people are seeing sticker shock. Okay? But that's the issue here. So already, this should be ominous to you. And that this, I don't know about you guys, I had not seen until I looked this up that in 2016 it was going to be $695 a person per year, or 2.5% of your income. I mean, that's a pretty big thing. Whereas, so you see how kind of slippery it is. Up front, it's only $95 per person per year. So they make it look like, oh, come on, it's not a big deal. It's not that onerous. Whereas if they had made it $695 right away, a lot of people probably would have been like, wait a minute, this might not be such a good thing. And maybe it's not just the government handing out cookies here. Okay. As far as winners or losers, we're kind of running low on time. I know you guys have got questions in the queue. Let me just very quickly mention some things here. You got to be careful. The so-called winners, of course, are the people who are getting, and I'm talking about the way this is couched in economic terms. I mean, obviously, the politicians are winners and things like that are people who want to have the government have a bigger role in the economy are winners. But what I mean here is in terms of the redistribution involved and the logic behind that. Obviously, people who before couldn't get health insurance and wanted it, and now they're able to get it, they're going to say, oh, yeah, this helped me. I'm glad that this happened. You know, and there are people like that. You know, I know people who didn't have insurance before because it was too expensive given their condition, or they literally were being denied. And then now they're able to get it because of Obamacare. They're, you know, they enrolled in the healthcare.gov or the state exchange. Okay, so you could say they're winning, but well, we're trying to figure out, how is this working? How can it be? You know, the government's not creating more doctors and nurses. So how can it? The government's not magically building more hospitals. So if now some people are getting more healthcare services, are there other people losing it? And it's not so that they're losing it, but it could be that the price goes way up, or other people are paying more for what the same service they used to get. And one thing that I don't see people mentioning is one type of loser is people's premiums are going to go up for a lot of people. So people who had insurance before, now it's going to be more expensive. And so you could argue in a sense that they're paying for the people who before were sick and couldn't get it. All right. But another group that I never see mentioned is, what about all the people who were uninsured, who were healthy and just didn't think it was worth it? Well, now they're being forced to buy something that technically they didn't want to buy before. And so, you know, that gets complicated as to say, well, are they being helped or hurt by this? And then, of course, the other thing is that you almost never see is, well, they're levying, you know, there's a big surtax on rich people coming through the Medicare tax. Okay, and we'll talk more about this next week when we go over the finances of this. We're going to walk through the projections of how much this is going to cost the government. It's going to cost the government, by their own projections, more than $1 trillion over the next decade. So when people say, "Oh no, this is going to save the government money," and that on net Obamacare is going to reduce the deficit, what they mean is because they're raising taxes as part of this legislation. All right. So when people are saying about how, oh no, or they'll say things like, well, no, even if your premium goes up, keep in mind you might be eligible for subsidies. And so you need to look and see, you actually have to go through the website and go to the other place and da da da. And you know, for all you know, even though it may look like your insurance is more expensive, actually you're saving money. And okay, but almost by definition, if the way they're making you save money and be a winner is because now the federal government is subsidizing your healthcare premium, well then obviously somebody's paying for that. Okay, let me, very quickly just hit one or two things and turn to your questions. I'm saying this not because I think it's actually that relevant right here, but I just want to make you not use an invalid argument. All right, so some people who are opponents of Obamacare, you know, people who are against it, they are saying stuff like, wait a minute, this is crazy. How could it possibly be that I'm going to be benefited by the government forcing me to do something? Right? And so they're kind of arguing it's impossible for Obamacare to make people better off in general because it's forcing us to do all this stuff. Okay, so again, I think in general that's a fine argument. I just want to warn you about a subtlety. You can kind of come up with scenarios. So for sure what is true is to say that if the government just forces you to do something that you didn't want to do before, that's obviously hurting you. Right? Because if it helped you to do the thing they're forcing you to do, you could have done it on your own. You'd be forced to do something that helps yourself. But it is at least theoretically possible that if the government forces everybody to do something, that makes everybody better off. Okay, again, I'm speaking in terms of standard economic analysis here. You guys know I'm a libertarian and all that stuff, so I'm not guffling. I'm trying to warn you about leaving yourself open to a counterattack. So one example I can think of is, or a couple examples. So certain big firms sometimes welcome government regulations on their industry. And at first glance, that doesn't make any sense. Why would like big Fortune 500 companies want the government to come in after the Tyco accounting scandal and do Sarbanes-Oxley and all that stuff and impose a bunch of accounting requirements and a bunch more paperwork on these firms? It's actually possible that behind the scenes, a lot of these big companies were for it. And the answer is because they know their smaller competitors can't comply with a bunch of bureaucracy as well as they can, because they have all kinds of legal departments and accounting teams and stuff like that, right? So you can imagine a scenario where a bunch of big companies in an industry might actually welcome government intervention in their industry. Okay, another thing with tobacco advertising, I haven't been able to verify this for sure myself, but when I was in college, one of the professors told us that actually, you know, so it used to be that you could advertise for cigarettes in magazines and stuff, you know, so you see ads like this from the 50s and 60s, but then at some point the government made that illegal. And I've heard arguments that actually the major tobacco companies were okay with that because they didn't want to, like, they were just engaged in an arms race. That if the major tobacco companies could just all agree to not advertise, you know, to cut their advertising budgets in half, they would all be better off. Because the idea was, tobacco ad, you know, for a particular cigarette, that doesn't get somebody to start smoking. That just possibly wins you over from a different brand. And so the idea was, look, since we're not bringing more people in through the advertising, let's just, if we could all agree to cut our advertising budgets in half, we would all have the same relative position, but we'd all save on the advertising. But you can't do that voluntarily because then somebody would cheat on the agreement. But if you could get the government to enforce that ban, then they'd all be better off because they still basically sell the same amount of cigarettes, but now they don't have to pay for advertising and magazines. Okay, so that's the logic. So with health insurance, you could come up with a simplified story in which everybody benefits from the government forcing everybody to get health insurance. Okay, so it's logically possible that could happen, even though in practice I don't think that is what's going on here. But anyway, I just want to warn you about the way those arguments work. Okay, let me stop here from the main lecture. I did want to cover some stuff, but this was in the article, The Economics of Obamacare, that I wrote for Mises.org, where I just walk through what would happen from having those planks that we talked about a few minutes ago. Okay, so Dennis Foster says, why are there open enrollment periods? Why can't you get change of policy anytime, like auto insurance? Like I said, Dennis, we're going to talk more about this, the specific details, in the next lecture, but I think part of it is for precisely what we've said, that they didn't want people gaming the system. They wanted everybody to sign up right away, because if they just had people coming and going as they please, then the risk pool gets all screwed up. So that what that might mean is initially, if people just had the freedom to jump in and go to healthcare.gov whenever they wanted, then it might, you know, people who are healthy might just sit back and wait, and all the sick people would sign up in the beginning. And then the insurance company, they would have to, you know, set the premiums based on that existing pool, and then the healthy people would look at those premiums and say, well, forget that, I'm not signing up. Okay, so they didn't want to have that kind of situation. But keep in mind, like I say, it's they did have that stuff about if you have a major life event. Okay, Kay Warren says, so Krugman says skip the insurance company's backstop and go straight to the government. Well, specifically, Kay, what he was arguing in that in the argument or the piece that I was summarizing in this lecture, he was just saying, this is why you can't have laissez-faire. So he was saying something like Obamacare would be justified, that where you could still have private insurance, but you would need the government to come in and heavily regulate it and not just let it be open to the free market. But you're right. He actually did say in a different article, after you had all this calamity with the healthcare.gov and the signing up and everything, he said, well, you know, the reason this is happening is because we're clinging to having private insurance companies involved, that really we don't need them. We ought to just have single payer. We all just have the federal government pay for everybody's medical expenses. In other words, like expanding Medicare to cover every American. So he wasn't saying it in that particular article that I was discussing, but he did say it elsewhere. Okay, Ms. Schaefer says, is it fair to say that Blue Cross and Blue Shield deliberately set up the industry practices so as to create a slush fund for the hospitals and doctors and to remove any incentives for the insurance companies to pressure providers to keep costs down? My guess is that that's what was going on, but I'm not going to claim to be an expert on historically how Blue Cross, why Blue Cross and Blue Shield did what they did. Kay Warren says, will every ACA applicant be means tested? Is this financial info going to be compared with the IRS's information? Well, for sure, if you want to get subsidies and such, you're going to have to somehow demonstrate that. Now you're asking a great question. Like if somebody on the form says, this is my income, blah, 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 are they going to cross-reference that? I think yes. I should probably go and double check that. But I mean, part of this is, here's my cynical side coming out. I think part of why they're doing this is a great way for them to get everybody to enter all their vital information into a federal database. I mean, you know, if you want to be conspiratorial for a minute, this is a great way to get millions of Americans to go log in and get all kinds of sensitive information, not only on their health history, but also every aspect of their financial history to the federal government, and then just hope that they maintain privacy. So yes, I mean, you would certainly think, Kay, that they would do it. But the reason I'm hesitating is I think it's going to be the worst of both worlds, where they will have that option and they will collect all the sensitive information and be able to share it with other agencies and whatever so that they can do what they want to do with it. But then in practice, I'm sure there's going to be outrageous fraud with this, where all kinds of people are going to be getting subsidies that technically are not eligible to get them. because that happens in every other area of government, right? So it's not in the individual bureaucrat's interest to save money because it doesn't go into his pocket. Okay, Dennis says, how can the politicians promise to keep costs down and avoid premiums from rising if there are no lifetime limits on insurance payments? I don't think they can, Dennis. I mean, that's, I think you're right. So next week we'll talk more about that issue. If you want, if you're saying, like, how could they even say that with a straight face? Like, what is their even theory, even if it's crazy? The idea is, if you get people, they're saying, look at right now, uninsured people are still getting coverage, are still getting care, but they're like going to the emergency room hospitals, right? And so they're saying if we can get everyone into the system and get more structured and orderly care, and then now the government has a lot more leverage and they can bargain with hospitals and get them to reduce prices, and they can say, oh, wait a minute, no, these kind of techniques are frivolous. They don't do anything. We're only going to pay for such and such. So they're going to engage in rationing. Okay, why don't we just look at, we have time. Why don't we do one more question and we'll end it for tonight, and I'll save your other question. Dan Murphy says, in the end, considering government's inability to produce and power only to coercively transfer wealth, who are the winners and losers in this? Insurance companies at the expense of the public, sick at the expense of the healthy, old at the expense of the young, etc. Right, so yeah, we did get into that a little bit. So clearly, you know, older people, and sick people, there's a sense in which, and people who don't make much money, there's a sense in which, yeah, they may end up getting more healthcare services at lower out-of-pocket expenses than would otherwise happen. So you can say, in a sense, they're winners. It's not as obvious. I think the insurance companies initially thought they would be winners because they thought, oh, look at all these millions of people are now going to be forced onto our rolls. But as this thing keeps twisting and turning, I'm guessing they're not as confident about that anymore, especially since it's not clear how many young, healthy people are going to sign up. But yeah, generally, I think so wealthier people who are getting hit with taxes, people like me who had catastrophic plans before that now do not meet the minimum standard and they're going to have to get more generous benefits than we wanted to pay for, are going to, you know, end up paying more. And then certainly younger people who didn't want insurance are being forced into it are arguably the losers too. Okay, why don't we stop there? William Dwyer, you said during office hours, could I repeat parts of the lecture where it broke down? Yeah, I will try to do that. And I guess that happened when I was at, I think it happened when I was on slide 4, when you guys started complaining about that. Okay, so sorry about the sound interruption, and I will see what I can do about fixing that. Okay, thanks, everybody.